Welcome to the New Zealand Foreign Trust Podcast with Kate Weiss, brought to you by Asia City Trust New Zealand Limited.
My name is Kate Weiss. I am the Managing Director of Asia City Trust New Zealand Limited. This is the first in a series of podcasts called the New Zealand Foreign Trust. This episode is all about New Zealand's place in the world. It's, in my opinion, the best jurisdiction for foreign trusts. My guest for this episode is Henry Brandt-Skeeson from Dentons.
Thanks, Kate. This is a good opportunity, I think, to talk about an interesting topic. I'm Henry from Dentons, which is the world's largest law firm, but I am a New Zealander and I practice on a global platform. So I see all different jurisdictions. I see and work with just about every trust jurisdiction there is, and I'm qualified in four jurisdictions and have practiced around the world. So whilst it's great to be on that global platform and to be jurisdictionally neutral in my work, it's also great to be able to talk about jurisdiction, which is obviously close to my heart.
So your four jurisdictions, I know you're UK, well, England, Wales and New Zealand.
Cook Islands and the British Virgin Islands as well.
Yeah, I forgot the British
Virgin Islands. I practiced in Jersey also for 10 years too. Yeah.
So just in case anybody wants to contact us, we're both available on LinkedIn. I have a weird spelling of my surname, which is W-E-I-S-S. I was speaking to somebody during the week who says, you're probably responsible for most of New Zealand's LinkedIn content. So you are quite widely recognisable on LinkedIn. Any tips on how to contact you on LinkedIn?
Probably just search me on LinkedIn. I do have quite a large following, I suppose, by LinkedIn standards. And I do use it a lot. As much as anything, I use it really to order my own thoughts, really, because I do a lot of reading. I don't get out very much. I like to read about our industry and what other jurisdictions are doing. And as I read, I write. And then when I write, I think, oh, well, if I'm going to be confident in what I believe, then I need to organize that thought and put it out there and open it up to scrutiny. So that's why I do what I do on LinkedIn. And I do learn a lot, and I hopefully others find some of that content interesting. So,
And obviously Dentons is an easy law firm to find because, you know, being the world's largest law firm. Asia City Trust, slightly harder to find. Asia City is actually spelled A-S-I-A-C-I-T-I rather than C-I-T-Y if you're trying to find that firm. The other thing just to talk about is the foreign trust, the New Zealand Foreign Trust, is distinguished from the domestic trust. So if people wanted to listen about New Zealand domestic trusts, this is not your podcast. Foreign trusts have neither New Zealand settlers nor beneficiaries. And that's important, because we'll talk about when we talk about taxation of trusts. So we're looking at choosing a jurisdiction today. In choosing jurisdictions, clients and intermediaries are faced with many choices. And through the last 25 years of working in this industry, many different lawyers and intermediaries have come up with various matrices setting out why people should choose different jurisdictions. And there's always been data sets which have included local regulatory requirements, political stability, whether a local trustee is required, annual governance. And this data is useful, in my opinion, when it comes to family governance and sustainability. For me, the key question is whether choosing a jurisdiction which will bring a family the least regulatory and legal intervention. So it's about sustainability for the future. For you, you've gone into a lot more detail. You wrote a paper published in September this year, which is a basic guide to selecting a trust jurisdiction. And you set out the advantages of choosing an offshore trust jurisdiction. So you set out the client should look at tax optimization, enhanced privacy, asset protection, facilitation of foreign direct investment, international trade, simplified reporting and regulatory environment designed to attract, pool and deploy capital, and political and economic stability for those from volatile regions. You also set out in this paper, which was a very interesting paper, the disadvantages of offshore jurisdictions, such as political, legal and reputational risks associated with perceptions of tax evasion, fraudulent conveyances or unethical financial practices, increased scrutiny from tax authorities and international regulatory bodies, leading to complex compliance requirements and customer due diligence. And additionally, less transparency and regulatory oversight can increase the risk of fraud and financial crime. So a couple of things to bring out of this, Henry. The first is, you set out that you believe that New Zealand is a midshore jurisdiction. So I wanted to look into what is a midshore jurisdiction rather than an offshore jurisdiction. And would using a midshore jurisdiction like New Zealand bring a competitive advantage over an offshore jurisdiction?
Sure. So it's interesting when you were introducing that topic, Kate, you sort of talked about the last 25 years of your career, and I also reflect on the last 25 years of my career and think about how things have changed. I mean, certainly at the beginning of my career, jurisdictional selection wasn't a particularly scientific or even sophisticated process. It typically related to or was determined by factors relevant to where the advisors were located and who they knew in the relevant jurisdictions, the sort of relationships they had, rather than necessarily some of the more fundamental criteria, I think, that you've gone through there. Now, there was nothing necessarily wrong with that. It was just a very siloed and narrow sort of way of thinking. And as a result, what happened is families in Europe would typically be structured in places like Jersey, Guernsey, the Isle of Man. Families in Latin America and Canada and the US would typically gravitate towards the Caribbean jurisdictions, and that was all fine in that sense. But I think now what's happening is we're seeing a far more sophisticated approach taken to jurisdictional selection. And actually at this point, it might be helpful just to talk about what do we mean by jurisdictional selection. What we mean is selecting a jurisdiction outside your home jurisdiction in which you can structure assets, whether it be private assets or investment assets or business assets. Now, this is where we get to the distinction, I think, between offshore and onshore. And when I started my career, I started in, you know, studied at law school, and I learned about the common law, and I learned about traditional sort of English common law. And I never really knew about offshore law until I went and practiced offshore. And then I realized that's a place where, well, offshore jurisdictions are places where wealth isn't necessarily created. That's usually created onshore, but through manufacturing or farming or agriculture or you know, extraction or financial services, whatever it may be. That's where the wealth is created onshore, but then typically it is held offshore, or commonly it is held offshore. It's intermediated, it's organized, it's structured, it's invested, it's deployed from offshore. And there's these pipes that go between offshore and onshore, which keep the two systems interconnected and keep capital flowing between the two. And that's typically how business and finance worked 25 years ago. There was sort of, there'd be big, large onshore jurisdictions like the US, Australia, Germany, the UK, all where wealth was being created and capital was raised, but nearly always there'd be satellite offshore jurisdictions around those big onshore jurisdictions where foreign investment was being aggregated, organized and deployed into those onshore jurisdictions. And also what was happening is, and continues to happen, is profits would be extracted from those onshore jurisdictions and held in those offshore jurisdictions. So that's sort of how this dichotomy between offshore and onshore evolved. That in itself was fine, but it did also lead to some rather aggressive types of planning and some loose regulation, because for the very reason that people would use an offshore jurisdiction, or one of the reasons would be not only for the tax neutrality, but also for the fact that it was just easy to do business. There was less friction in opening accounts. There was a lot more privacy, and the regulatory oversight in terms of, you know, the ability to procure services was lower, because there wasn't the strict regulations that are designed to protect sort of retail investors in onshore jurisdictions. So that led to some aggressive practices and frankly misuse through tax evasion and money laundering. And as a result of that, offshore jurisdictions, ever since about President Reagan's war on drugs in the 1980s, offshore jurisdictions were subject to a lot more scrutiny and regulation, and to the point where the playing field is now very much level. There's a lot more regulatory oversight and regulation in the offshore jurisdictions, much like there is in the onshore jurisdictions. So the same sort of standards have applied. But that's also led to what I refer to in my paper as a midshore jurisdiction, which is a jurisdiction which sort of sits in between the two on the spectrum. And it's a jurisdiction which has many of the same features of an offshore jurisdiction, like tax neutrality and privacy and innovative laws to encourage and attract business from outside its borders, but with all the same regulatory oversight and protections for consumers, strong, robust in courts and the enforcement of the rule of law, and also some economic substance around the industry. So one of the criticisms or one of the limitations of many offshore jurisdictions is they're just small countries with very little legal, professional, institutional infrastructure like banks and stock exchanges and access to liquidity from within the jurisdiction. And so that's been a limitation for and continues to be a limitation for many offshore jurisdictions. So a midshore jurisdiction is sort of a hybrid of the two. It's a place where international business can be facilitated, where capital can live in a tax neutral environment, be structured using English common law structures which are universally recognized, but also have the protections of an independent court and the conveniences of an onshore jurisdiction in terms of the institutional and advisory ecosystems around them.
I think that's a really interesting point about that difference between the offshore trust jurisdiction and exactly what you've said, that it's not really what it says in its tin, that it's meant to be this place where you have these economies of scale, that it's meant to be this international offshore centre where you have the banks, you have the oversight, and that these midshore jurisdictions have grown up because of that need. And so if we look at the kind of jurisdictions that we're talking about as a midshore jurisdiction, so New Zealand, Singapore, the likes of Malta, Ireland, states in the United States like Delaware, Wyoming, South Dakota, we're looking at Luxembourg. I think, you know, people would be surprised that they're considered these midshore jurisdictions, because a few people would probably consider an island an onshore jurisdiction. You can even put England in to a certain extent as a midshore jurisdiction when it comes to corporate planning. Do you think that the midshore jurisdiction perhaps is considered more legitimate in the eyes of those who feel that people who use offshore jurisdictions and planning is somewhat immoral or incorrect once, you know, the people who have this issue with the wealthy becoming more wealthy and putting their money offshore?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a challenge for those of us that work in this cross-border wealth structuring industry to communicate the legitimacy of the industry. And the reality is that the industry is also a victim of its history. There's no question that offshore jurisdictions were used for abusive practices, for money laundering and for tax evasion. Now, and to some extent that will continue today, just like it happens in onshore jurisdictions as well. So there's a legacy perception issue there. But I think well-informed observers will know that the reality is that in a globalized, interconnected world, capital will flow to those places where it is able to be received and organized and structured in the most efficient way possible. And some jurisdictions are better at attracting that capital than others. And some jurisdictions absolutely rely on that for their own sustainability and because they have no or few other industries. So, and probably the most profound change that's happened in my career over the last 25 years has been the legitimization of cross-border wealth structuring from being an industry which was perceived adversely to one which is now, I think, at least by informed observers, seen as one which is critical to maintaining capital flows between jurisdictions, to facilitating international trade, and to protecting the legitimately earned property of families who create wealth, you know, business owning and creating families, and ones also that are increasingly living across borders. It's another thing. I think historically families have probably tended to stay within their own borders or within their own regions, that their business activities have been conducted within those regions. But increasingly now in a globalized, interconnected world where we can fly anywhere and we can communicate from anywhere, businesses are operating across borders, families are living across borders, and that people are living longer, families are getting bigger, and their wealth needs to be, is also growing and becoming more complicated in terms of the asset classes. And so providing neutral jurisdictions for these families to organize their affairs and to conduct their business activities is legitimate. It's not actually an industry which serves to help these families evade their responsibilities in their home country. Quite the contrary, these structures are now, as a result of the Common Reporting Standard and of FATCA and anti-money laundering legislations, they're all reported, tax are paid on profits at source, and there's very limited opportunities, I think, to hide wealth in an offshore jurisdiction. You'd be far have a far better opportunity to do that onshore or using other ways. So I think there is an educational challenge there that we have in our industry, but I think that gradually the mainstream population is accepting that offshore structuring is just a part of living in 2024. Every pension fund, superannuation fund, financial structure that we interact with or have in our portfolios, whether we know it or not, will have some connection to an offshore jurisdiction, and that's not inherently a bad thing. In many cases, it will be for very, very good and legitimate reasons. Now, you went through a list of sort of jurisdictions there, which we recognise as being midshore jurisdictions. I mean, it's probably worth noting that it's offshore, onshore, and midshore. This is not a term of art, and I've got in my mind a loose, broad categorization there of what's an offshore, onshore, or midshore jurisdiction. To be honest, that what I think doesn't really matter, and to some extent, none of these terms mean anything. They're just for me a conceptual framework that I use. Now, you're right to suggest that, well, the City of London is arguably an offshore jurisdiction. Actually, every country in the world that I know of, anyway, uses fiscal policy in some way to attract economic activity into its borders, into its jurisdiction, in order to then tax that economic activity. So you're not necessarily taxing the capital that comes in, but you're taxing the economic activity that is generated by that capital. So every country in the world that I can think of does that. They do it for their fund managers, they do it for their financial institutions, they do it for other non-financial sectors. And so there's probably, if you went through every country in the world, you could probably mount a case that to some extent they are participating in this industry, and therefore could be said to be an onshore or a midshore jurisdiction. It is probably fair to say that some of the smaller countries in the world, the island nations, the Caribbean, Channel Islands, for them there is more incentive and need to organize themselves to pass legislation to attract this type of business than large countries with diversified economies, because those countries often don't have very much else that they can export to the world other than tourism, possibly some fishing or something like that. For them, they have more of an incentive, and therefore are often more their industries or their economies are more concentrated on this sector, whereas other countries like New Zealand and Ireland and Switzerland and so forth, they have more diversified economies, so it's not such a big part of their economy. So for that reason as well as others, the mature jurisdictions tend to escape a little bit of scrutiny than some of the offshore jurisdictions. And also in the mature jurisdictions, just by virtue of the fact they're bigger, they have universities, they have stock exchanges, they have capital markets, they have just a bit more infrastructure around them, whereas in those smaller jurisdictions, they often don't. They have a small population, often they don't have universities, so the young people leave, and so they don't have what's now called the same sort of economic substance or operational functionality that a mature or so-called mature jurisdiction will have. So for that reason, they can be a bit more constrained than a mature jurisdiction. But I think, and I want to make it clear that, you know, there'll be people listening to this and thinking, well, that my classification system isn't very good. And it is just my classification system. But certainly I think that I'm sure people in places like Jersey would argue, well, we're actually a mature jurisdiction because even though they're small, tiny population, they've actually got a lot of economic substance there. So there's arguments that can be made. And I think it's a general trend across our careers, really, that we've seen this leveling of the playing field, and the distinction now is not as obvious as it once was.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. Just when you were talking about the impact of something like economic substance on an offshore jurisdiction, it reminds me of when I was actually living in the British Virgin Islands and they just announced economic substance, and I was at a bar, which you might recall, the Soggy Dollar Bar out on Jos Van Dyke, and on the Sunday morning, and the barman said to me, "Kate, I've heard about this economic substance and we're not going to have any more companies in the British Virgin Islands. What are we going to do?" And he was, you know, "This is where we get all the money for our country. This is why we don't pay much tax," because income tax rate was something like 10% out there. And I said, "Don't worry, economic substance, you know, we run our companies," because I was working for a trust and company service provider out there, "in a robust fashion. Just because we're offshore, we will provide economic substance. The ones that need economic substance will and do have economic substance. This does not mean the end of the industry," but it affected barmen on an outer island of the British Virgin Islands because they do rely on the revenue that is paid to the government for the companies on an annual basis in the British Virgin Islands for the livelihood of most of the people in the country. So that point that you were making about what makes an offshore jurisdiction an offshore jurisdiction is to the extent that they do rely on the revenue from their offshore, from the revenue that they make on the tax of the offshore companies on an annual basis.
Yeah, it's really important. I think it's easy for commentators in onshore jurisdictions to judge offshore jurisdictions harshly and adversely. But ultimately, they, like every other sovereign nation on earth, have their right to make their own laws to suit their purposes and to attract business. Now, that's been happening since time began. Now, onshore jurisdictions don't necessarily like this because they perceive that this is an extractive industry, that the offshore jurisdictions are extracting profit and capital from onshore jurisdictions, which is then depriving those onshore jurisdictions of tax revenue for social services and things like that. Now, that's certainly an argument that is raised commonly, but I don't know that it entirely bears scrutiny because there is certainly significant evidence, as has been borne out in many studies, that offshore jurisdictions actually create wealth, create economic activity, not just in their own jurisdictions, but actually in the onshore jurisdictions as well, because they enable capital to be pulled and then deployed into onshore jurisdictions. And I think there's plenty of empirical evidence to show that is the case. So the argument that offshore jurisdictions are harmful is, I think, a fallacy. But be that as it may, there is no doubt that there's been a historical legacy there that offshore jurisdictions have to deal with. And the reality is, I think that they've dealt with that really well. They've been very responsive over the last 30 years of regulation of the industry because, as you quite rightly mentioned, they have to be. If they if they don't respond to the onshore or the OECD jurisdictions, if they don't respond to their calls for greater regulation, then they'll be sanctioned. They'll be blacklisted, and that's we've seen that happen over the years. And so they do. They respond. They were the first movers on AML regulation, well before other countries onshore started doing that. And they were the first movers on FATCA and the Common Reporting Standard, and again on economic substance. And it's probably and all of those regulatory impositions have affected the industry in the sense that they've increased the cost of doing business, but they've also, I think, made the industry far more sustainable and legitimate. And so whilst at the time they were quite challenging to respond to from a business perspective, I think they have actually been good for business. Now, economic substance is a possibly a harder one in the sense that it's not just a matter of passing laws and creating policies and procedures for trustees and bankers and lawyers to follow. It now also requires a significant investment in human infrastructure because it basically says that if you're setting up a company offshore, you need to have significant or greater economic activity by that company in that jurisdiction, not necessarily doing all the economic activity outside the jurisdiction. And that requires people, and it requires real business to be transacted. And that is more challenging, but I think because many of those companies don't exist, or to do business in their home, in the jurisdiction in which they're registered. And the reality is much of the talent won't be present in that jurisdiction. So you won't be able to, for a hedge fund, for example, they won't have quantitative analysts, qualitative analysts. They won't have the researchers and others available in the offshore jurisdiction. They can get the governance. There's no shortage of good directors in many offshore jurisdictions, but then there's a limit on how many directorships a person should and can take anyway. So there are some operational issues there. But what I think is happening is many of those companies that you spoke about in the BVI, I think back when I started my career, there was nearly a million BVI companies. I'm not sure. And I think over time that number has decreased dramatically. But I don't think profits will fall at the same rate, because I think many of those companies actually probably weren't necessarily providing that much economic benefit to those offshore jurisdictions. And so we're just getting an increase, I think, or an improvement in governance and an increase in the economic activity done, albeit by a fewer number of companies.
Thank you very much for listening to today's podcast. We have discussed at length, thank you, Henry, about what offshore, onshore and midshore jurisdictions are. I think we've been able to highlight that in New Zealand, we're able to draw from the best of both worlds, the offshore and the onshore attributes, and wrap them up in the midshore wrapper. In the next podcast, we're going to be looking at New Zealand on the global stage. We're going to look at tax optimization, privacy, asset protection, regulatory environment, corruption, political and economic stability, trust law, and summarise where New Zealand sits as against other jurisdictions. Thank you all very much for listening. Thank you, Henry, for joining me. Henry will join me in the next podcast as well. Henry, any last thoughts?
Thanks, Kate. No, that was a really interesting and relevant discussion, I think, to discuss those conceptual differences. And then in the next episode, we'll get a little bit more granular, I suppose, about the benefits of New Zealand and the features of New Zealand as a jurisdiction.
And just if you want to look up about Asia City Trust, Asia City is spelled ASIACITI, and the website's asiacitytrust.com.